Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We'll ease into the show today with some light material because there was a bet that was made yesterday that we want to make sure we get registered in terms of who was victorious. Not between me and Amy, but between Amy and Mike from the North Side. And then also, obviously, as we advertised our company picnic
which
yesterday,
some listeners wanted to come to.
Oh, of course
they
did. I had
to break their hearts and let them know it's just for employees. So it was a welcome back picnic.
I'm sure people are waiting with bated breath to find out who won the three-legged race.
Well, we didn't have the three-legged race this year or the wheelbarrow race. We had
what about hard-boiled eggs and a spoon in your mouth, that race, the egg race?
Didn't have that one. Or the pin the tail on the donkey. We didn't do that either. We did cornhole.
Yeah.
Otherwise known as bags.
Yeah.
And guess who made it to the championship round?
Wow, among all of the...
all of the 12 people.
The top-tier athletes that are employed at AM 560.
I'm Division I material.
Yeah.
No, I made it with my new friend Kevin. Kevin and I made it to the championship round. We beat Jeff Reisman and Dave Butterfield. I think that's his name.
Yeah.
I know Dave. He was a little salty. And so was Eric Thomas. When Eric lost in bags, he was out of his mind. I've never seen him mad or angry in my 10 years working here.
It's competitive. And so
he is.
And so then you lost to who?
Oh, thank you. Well, we were up 15-3 in the finals. And we lost, Kevin and I lost to two newcomers, Alejandra, I believe.
Their names are Justin and Quinn. They produce this show. They're
sure.
Not newcomers.
Yeah, Justin and Quinn. We lost to Justin and Quinn. I actually beat Quinn in the first round. And I was trying to lose because I wanted to go home because I have to take a nap like an old lady.
Yeah, of course.
And have my Jell-O. But I couldn't, once the game starts, you know, coach, you can't turn that competitive spirit off. So then I wanted to bust everyone's head open and win the game. And we won a bunch. So we did win a $25 gift card from Amazon.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's wonderful.
I already bought a water bottle with it. And I want to thank Debbie Litwin and Jeff Reisman.
Now the sucking up you'll have to endure. Okay.
Give me 30 seconds.
Yeah.
That was a very well-organized event. They had Josh's out in Northbrook. They came and set up. They had French fries. I love French fries. They had French fries, a cheddar burger, Vienna hot dogs. It was really good. But also, too, she arranged the bags tournament, and she did a really good job picking teams.
Now, does everybody feel like they were there?
Yes.
After that vivid description?
Yes.
It's wonderful. I'm glad the transfer payments to you have not stopped either.
Right. But we missed you.
Yeah. So the bet with Mike from the North Side, something mildly interesting.
You know what? This is very interesting because it involves cash in my pocket.
You said that in 2010, you pulled a Republican ballot to vote for a young upstart candidate for governor named Dan Proft.
I sure as heck did. And he debated me.
He disputed you. He said there's no way that happened because you were still a Democrat. You were still part of, you're still sort of part of the culture of the network affiliate press corps in this city.
He called me a Lincoln Park Trixie.
Yeah, he did, actually.
I'm a Lakeview Trixie.
Get it right.
I don't drive Jettas. We drive minivans.
I pulled your voter card.
Thank you.
And
I asked him to do that, but it's public record anyway. It's public
and
knowledge.
2002, Democrat primary ballot.
Oh, boy.
Amy Jacobson, 2006, Democrat primary. 2008, Democrat primary. 2009, Democrat.
I did? No, primary. I didn't. No, I didn't.
Yeah.
Oh, that was for a special election that we had for a congressional race.
Right. Yeah, to replace one.
Who left?
Quigley
came
could
in.
It have been Tiny Dancer?
Oh, excuse me. Thank you. We didn't have any Republicans running that.
And
then 2010, somebody woke up.
Republican.
Thank you.
Republican ballot pulled in 2010.
And then all the other rest is all
2012, Republican, 2014 Republican. Yeah. There was an epiphany that occurred around the turn of last decade. And
better late than never.
That's right. Always leave room for people to come over to your side. And Mike from the North Side, he was adamant about putting down
$500. So how?
He put down a nickel. So Mike from the North Side, he's probably sleeping in a work truck, City Hall work truck right now. So somebody wake him up and tell him to scramble some cash. And, you know, we'll arrange the transfer. Like the pallets of cash we gave to the Iranians, similar. That's what we want. But Mike on the North Side owes you $500.
I'm so bad at collecting money and debts.
Well, that's where you help Rocco and Moose, or you have Rocco and Moose help Mike find his wallet.
I'll send Bunky and Bubba.
You can't welch on bets.
All right.
Can't welch. So Mike on the North Side, that's
what's our nickel. The Pritzker's not going to run.
Yeah, and I don't know. Probably by Labor Day, you'll owe me $100,000. So I wouldn't go spend that $500.
It's $100.
Oh, I thought you wanted to upgrade it to $100,000.
But we didn't shake on it, though.
Oh, nice out.
$100.
Listen to AM 560 The Answer online at 560theanswer.com, on the AM 560 mobile app, on your Alexa-powered smart speaker, and on TuneIn, iHeart, and on Odyssey.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Javier Becerra is Joe Obama's HHS secretary, third term. Remember, he said this last week about the government's right to know, right to compel in defense of the forthcoming COVID vaccine ambassador program that our very own Lake County, Illinois, is all geared up to start. They've got the draft scripts and everything.
Yeah, we did a wonderful rendition.
Yeah.
Of what, you know, hypothetically could happen. Yeah.
Like a workshop for future COVID vaccine ambassadors.
Yeah, no solicitation signs.
This is how it works, okay? And he outlines this nicely. The federal government takes your money, and because it now has your money, it can decide whether or not to spend your money on you, depending on whether or not you comply with them. That's how it works.
Got it?
I wonder if you can answer that criticism. It's none of the government's business knowing who has or hasn't been vaccinated. What do you say?
Brianna, perhaps we should point out that the federal government has had to spend trillions of dollars to try to keep Americans alive during this pandemic. So it is absolutely the government's business. It is taxpayers' business if we have to continue to spend money to try to keep people from contracting COVID and helping reopen the economy. And so it is our business to try to make sure Americans can prosper, Americans can freely associate. And knocking on a door has never been against the law. You don't have to answer, but we hope you do, because if you haven't been vaccinated, we can help dispel some of those rumors that you've heard and hopefully get you vaccinated.
Yeah, there you go. We're spending trillions of dollars of your money, and so we're not spending it on you if you don't do what we say you should do. Kathleen Sebelius was the HHS secretary in Joe Obama term one. She's, version 1.0. Becerra is version 2.0. But you're about to hear the thread that connects the two. Kathleen Sebelius from Kansas, incredibly. What's the matter with Kansas and D, Thomas Frank? How they ever elected Kathleen Sebelius? Listen to what she had to say. Also on CNN, of course, the platform for these sort of announcements about the unvaccinated and what should be done with them at this juncture.
We are in a situation where we have a wildly effective vaccine, multiple choices, lots available, free of charge, and we have folks who are just saying, I won't do it. I think that it's time to say to those folks, it's fine if you don't choose to get vaccinated, you may not come to work. You may not have access to a situation where you're going to put my grandchildren in jeopardy, where you might kill them, where you might put them in a situation where they're going to carry the virus to someone in a high-risk position. That's, I think, the point where we are, is freedom is one thing. But freedom, when you harm others, like secondhand smoke and issues that we've dealt with very clearly in the past, you can't drive drunk. You can drink, but you can't drive drunk because you can injure other people. You can't smoke inside of a public place where you can give cancer to someone else in spite of their never having been a smoker. So I think we're reaching that point in the United States where those of us who are vaccinated, I want to take off my mask. I want to be able to live my life with vaccination. And right now I'm being impinged on by people who say, I don't want to get vaccinated. It's fine, but I want them to maybe have a limitation on where they can go and who they can possibly infect.
Oh, creating two cultures here in the United States.
So which is more interesting to you, the internment camps for the unvaccinated or her comparison? Well, there's three choices. Her internment camps for the unvaccinated, her suggestion that you could kill her grandchildren because they're a high-risk category.
She's so wrong.
Or number three, the comparison of the unvaccinated to cancer treatments, refusing cancer, to smokers, to drunk drivers.
Yeah, drunk drivers.
There's a lot to pour over there, a lot that she's given us to think about, and I certainly do appreciate it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, just on the science for a second, since she was the Secretary of the Health and Human Services Agency, just let that wash over you for a second. She was a governor of a state. First of all, there's no real clear causal link between passive smoking and lung cancer. So secondhand smoke. Secondly, your grandchildren are not a high-risk category.
Not at all.
Your grandchildren are more affected, potentially, by the flu than by COVID-19. So I assume, Ms. Sebelius, that you would take the same position with respect to flu shots. Anybody who didn't get the flu shot who might come in contact with your grandchildren and kill them, they should be treated like the unvaccinated. Is that correct? That would be an interesting follow-up.
It is so grossly irresponsible what she said. And she knows better. They're just trying to scare people to take the vaccine.
On the metaphors, like a cancer patient refusing cancer treatment. So when one of us has COVID, we all have COVID. I don't have COVID. So how can I be refusing a treatment for a condition I don't have, akin to a cancer patient, a condition they do have, refusing treatment for their condition?
But the bottom line, this is America. We should have a choice, and where our freedoms are being stomped on, and then we're being bullied if we don't get vaccinated.
Yeah, I get that. I get all that. I just, the quality of the line of argumentation from the head, formerly, of the Health and Human Services Agency administration. Don't you find that remarkable? Or is it just we become inured to mediocre intellects and general buffoons being in charge of our government and our lives in so many respects? Have we just become immune to it, to borrow a word?
And then, you know, saying that they could, if you don't kill my grandchildren because you didn't get vaccinated, they could spread it to vulnerable communities. What's the transmission rate from students, say, to teacher? 0.0637 in New York.
Here's my thing on this. Yeah, you can go through all the data. You can go through the logic and the quality of Sebelius's comparisons. You can go through the imperious Becerra opinion about your money and how it will or will not be spent on you. The people who think they're smart and who think they're informed and who think they're compassionate, this needs to be presented to them. You are a buffoon if you listen to the Sebeliuses and the Beceras of the world and nod your head like that's making sense. That's some leadership. That's what I see. That's some courage. That's some quality independent thinking going on between the years of one Kathleen Sebelius and one Javier Becerra. If you think that, you are a buffoon. You're probably the one that should be separated from the gene pool, and not the person who says, I'm not going to get vaccinated because I don't want to. I think the risk of the vaccine is greater than the risk of getting infected, considering a 99.95 recovery rate for persons under the age of 70. And obviously that skews even higher as you go down age demographics. And I don't care what Kathleen Sebelius or Olivia Rodrigo, who was there at the press briefing yesterday, this little pop star to encourage young people to get the vaccine. I don't care what they say. Here's my thinking on it. And you bump my thinking up against the quality of the arguments you're hearing from the Beceras and the Sebeliuses. How about that conversation? Tom and Oswego, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, I agree with you. The more I listen to these politicians, and I guess I've always known this, I feel the people that follow these people, the collective IQ has been dropping daily. I would not want these people to even work in my business. They just don't sound intelligent enough. They don't have common sense. And I'm talking from the top down, President Biden all the way down. I listen to these people quite often on the news, and I hear their comments, and I just feel this is probably the only job they can have.
Thanks for the call, Tom. I mean, listen, forget ideology. Forget even the issue of whether or not you think everybody should be vaccinated or whether or not you want to get vaccinated. Just the quality of the thinking that would compare a cancer patient refusing treatment to somebody who doesn't have COVID saying, I don't want to get the vaccine. So that doesn't mean, by the way, if I did get infected, I wouldn't want ivermectin or some other therapeutic. It doesn't mean that if you weren't demagoguing it and engaged in fear mongering, and I otherwise wasn't feeling particularly threatened based on the data, I wouldn't get it. It doesn't mean the FDA potentially finally approves it for something more rigorous than emergency use that I won't get it. But just on the ability to make sense, the left doesn't make any sense. Forget the position, forget the issue. Just focus on the quality of the thinking. Because if you don't make sense, then maybe your underlying position isn't particularly compelling or credible.
I just think they're desperate at this time to try and get people to get vaccinated. I mean, they throw, you know,
they're
thinking you throw money at the
problem.
Why
are they desperate?
Why are they desperate? Because they have all these vaccines that they want to use, and they want people. I don't know why. Because they think that it's going to eradicate COVID.
Is that why?
COVID's never going to be eradicated.
Is that what do you think that they?
It's about
you think,
power.
You think they think that if everybody follows our lead, then we will eliminate this virus, and you know, heaven on earth will ensue. Is that what they really think? That's the basis. I'm just so
stop
concerned
other variants
about COVID.
If the lambda's not going to come if we can all get vaccinated.
Why are they desperate? Why are they engaged in statements that are demonstrably untrue? Because they care so much? Is it they care too much? Is that why?
No. They want their power. I don't know. You tell me.
Barbara in Lakeview.
My head's spinning right now.
Hi. I think this is finally divided into the battle that was inevitable, a split between the people who refuse to be made to feel vulnerable and the people who will continue to feel vulnerable no matter what they do. I mean, we are refusing to be made afraid, and there are people who will be afraid no matter what they do, and I refuse to let them rule my life. If they want to make this the war of the vaccines, I'm ready to fight that war.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for the call, Barbara. Yeah, Barbara's taking the old FDR advice that there's nothing to fear but a virus from the Wuhan virology lab. I think that's what he said.
Yeah, no.
Jim in Belvedere.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say what I said to the screener is my holdout for not taking the vaccine is the FDA has not approved it yet. I don't know why people are not pushing these politicians to say, why is the FDA not approving this? What's the big deal? Why is the FDA silent?
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Jim. So here's the thing about that.
Yes. Can you help us out?
The FDA, first of all, the FDA takes a long time to approve things that it should approve. The FDA is not a hero in this story. And it's not some sort of heroic agency. There's a lot of legitimate criticisms lodged in the direction of the FDA for holding up potentially helpful drugs and medical devices. We know this because what did we do in the Trump administration with bipartisan support because of the pressure from the public? The right to try legislation, the right to try law. So the FDA is, you know, beset by regulatory sclerosis, just like most federal agencies. However, the underlying point when people mean when they say, you know, the FDA formal approval, not emergency use authorization, what they're saying is the quality of the clinical trials, the extent of the clinical trials, particularly, you know, again, as you go from 18 and up to 12 to 18 to now looking at 2 to 12. And the assessment of risk of adverse outcomes in comparison to an assessment of risk based on everything we know through the lived experience of the last 18 years and the aggregation of the data, 18 months, and the aggregation of the data, the risk, various cohorts, various conditions to infection. And so when we say FDA, people are really saying, I want more definitive research that lays out a comprehensive view of the relative risks. And that's perfectly rational. Paul and Worth.
In your words, Dan, I've heard you say this, these people like Becerra and Sebelius give off the illusion of knowledge. And Dennis Prager just said the other day, the irrational have taken over our country. And Amy, a few minutes back, did you just use the word stompled?
Stompled? Was stompled used? Was stompled called?
I don't think I used stomple. I don't
Thank
know.
You guys.
Thanks, Paul. I don't know.
I've never used
it. We'll review the tape. Yeah, well, it's a rationality, but it's a particular kind of irrationality. And this is, you know, talk about this routinely. Sentimentalism. It's sentimentality over reason. And something else, since Paul is quoting myself back to me, I want to reference as Flannery O'Connor's wonderful observation that sentimentality leads to the gas chamber. It's all feeling and no thinking. And to the point that Barbara from Lakeview made, they want you to feel afraid. And when you feel afraid,
they want you to, more.
They want you to feel like they're going to take care of you. And so what they're really proposing is that everybody just peaceably live on their knees. And Barbara in Lakeview,
she'd rather die standing than live on her knees.
And that's right.
Good for her.
Absolutely right. I'm completely in her camp. Pete and Racine.
Good morning. Say there's a couple old-fashioned ways for people that are coming and knocking on your door. One of them is a no soliciting sign. The other one is a no trespassing sign. And the comment, you have not been invited on my property. Unless you get off in the next 10 seconds, I will call the police or have to defend my property.
Well, all right.
Okay.
Pete is not going to be welcoming any COVID vaccine ambassadors, it doesn't sound like.
No, he will not.
Cassandra in Ravenswood.
Good morning. The FDA cannot approve a drug for emergency use if there is another treatment. This is why hydroxychloroquine and buprenorphine and now ivermectin had to be subterraneaned, put under cover, because the big pharma pays over $25 billion combined to the medical community and to the media in advertising dollars, direct advertising dollars, and then payments to doctors for consultancies and speeches. So that's why you've heard so much nonsense from these doctors. Like, remember the doctor who said, oh, hydroxychloroquine, Trump's going to die. This is why we heard this. Because to assume that every doctor is not corruptible by the fact that, well, I'm not going to get $100,000 in my speaking fees, and that's what's paying for my yacht. So we have lived with what is a kowtowing to big pharma's interests, because they couldn't make billions on future vaccinations, when, in fact, all along, people's lives could have been saved, people's lives could have been, suffering could have been alleviated for people who experienced it but didn't die from it. this has all been a huge grift. And I'm sorry to say it, but I get that if I'm getting $500 million in advertising dollars from Big Pharma, I'm not liable to get on TV and say, guess what? Hydroxychloroquine in this study, it works.
Yeah.
So I just think that all of this is such complete nonsense. And Sebelius was an idiot before, and she's proved it again and again. And they only roll these people out when they help the propaganda campaign.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for the call, Cassandra. Good call. I mean, here's the thing. It's a problem because you get away with the grift, as Cassandra said, when the outcome is something that has a lot of apparent positive impacts, which the vaccines do, apparently. Now, I know there's arguments about this emergency use authorization and clinical trials that indicate a higher incidence of autoimmune issues, like, you know, 6, 9, 12 months down the road. There's been some studies of that. But, in terms of what we know now, the vaccine is largely safe and largely effective. The vaccines are. And so because you have this, you know, people are willing to overlook all of the issues that Cassandra is raising about, pharma's grifting the medical community, the public health community, obviously the political community, and deriving a great benefit from that sort of rent-seeking behavior because of this positive outcome. And it's an important point because it calls into question whether or not we're going to live in a world where the ends justify the means, or we're going to say, no, there's something moral or immoral about the means employed to a particular end. And you can't just reverse engineer that without consequence or without implication or without reflection or without consequence. It's a really interesting dynamic she brings up. There's a lot to unpack, but I'm glad she did. Chuck and Delavan.
I can't say them girls with the names. Hey, I'm working on that backup video for you today. I got a kid coming over to film it. I called in to tell you I'm not taking a vaccine, and everybody that lives around here that I know drinks in a bars with me and stuff. You'll never take us alive. We ain't going for it. And that's just the way we feel. So anyway, have a good day.
All right. Wolverine, says Chuck and Delavan.
And we got a text message in. Good morning, Dan and Amy. My daughter's going to DePaul where they have mandatory vaccines for students, but not for staff. My daughter got a medical exemption for the vax. DePaul accepted 2 months ago. They emailed her yesterday telling her she can't live in the dorms without a vaccine despite the exemption.
Well, yeah.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
You're hearing this from colleges, too, where the vaccine is not mandated because they don't want the legal exposure. But, right, if you get infected, you have to quarantine. There's going to be no provision for you. So if you have to miss 2 weeks of class and you miss three classes and one of your classes, you know, if you have three unexcused absences, then you fail. Your professor can fail you and so on and so forth. So they're going to make it as difficult as possible. Of course they are. This is the
just
point.
Cruel.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're going to continue our punishment this morning of our listeners by exposing them to
more singing.
Well, no, the thinking of the left, which is even more cacophonous than your singing. That's how bad it is.
Wow.
Kamala Harris, Reparation Aid. She's the vice president of the United States. And she had a confab yesterday talking about those Texas Democrat socialists who abdicated to D.C. Asked about their import and impact, and she continued with her unhinged hyperbole.
We had an extensive meeting. I had an extensive meeting yesterday with, I think, some of the most courageous elected leaders.
Oh, my heroes.
That we could know at this moment. I said it yesterday, and I'll say it again. They took bold, courageous action in line with the legacy of everyone from Frederick Douglass, who's over my right shoulder, when he fought for the right of black men to vote in America, to the legacy that includes all those women who marched down Pennsylvania Avenue for women's right to vote, to all of those folks who shed their blood on the Edmund Pettus Bridge to make sure that we would, in 1965, pass the Voting Rights Act. And now we have in 2021 the Texas legislature, many of them, traveling to Washington, D.C.
Frederick Douglass, the suffragettes.
The 1965 Voting Rights Act.
And your Texas Dem state legislators.
No, they're heroes. They're heroes of the left. Hero fugitives of the left, I should say. Because they had to flee. It was so bad in Texas. They had to get out of there. Give me a break. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
It's really is a remarkable statement. It's a remarkable statement because, you know, if you look at Frederick Douglass's scholarship, and there's a lot of worthy scholarship there, he's completely opposed to the things that animate the left today. I mean, he was opposed to government conferring benefits or assigning responsibilities based on race. Explicitly, he was opposed to that after being, after being freed as a slave, being freed from bondage. Why was he opposed to that? Because he understood that establishing racial orders enforced by the government is a bad idea because you never know which side of that racial order you're going to find yourself on. That is the complete purpose of the modern Democrat Socialist Party and all of this nonsense about Frederick Douglass. Does this even need to be discussed? It needs to be discussed only to the sense that hear this clip and share it with your friends. And if anybody thinks that Kamala Harris is making sense,
please,
that is a legitimate comparison. A bunch of part-time legislators in Texas leaving the state to come to D.C. to be with their fellow socialists because they were going to lose a vote in the Texas state legislature. That is comparable to what Frederick Douglass did, to what the suffragettes did, to what the civil rights movement did in terms of moving the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. Those four groups of people are the same. This was Frederick Douglass' favorite song, too, I recall.
And did you hear this? Representative Tallarico, he's one of the dozens of Texans who left.
Yeah.
He said, none of my colleagues wanted to do this. My colleagues are leaving behind their kids, some of them leaving behind dying family members. One of my colleagues canceled her wedding that was scheduled to be held this
weekend. I know. This is
There's a lot of tears. I mean, are you
kidding
me?
You heard Kamala. Everything is being done at great personal and political risk. What risk?
This is their last resort.
Personal and political. What's the political? I mean, I assume for most of those Democrats, their constituents support this kind of nonsense because, you know, they're just as like, you know, addled by Trump hate as the legislators are. That's it. To not like Trump is to be able to justify any statement and any position.
Bingo.
Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Oh, hey, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. Bingo is right. I'm sitting here and I had fun. I take and scream what I think. Anything the left does and everything, they take and burn down cities, just take over police stations, burn them down, kill people, destroy every damn thing and everything. They're praised. Even the vice president comes out, praises all that kind of crap. When Trump supporters go over to take and raise their voices at the Capitol, they're locked up and they're criminals and they're still locked up. I mean, like what they want to do in Cuba and everything. It's like Cuban law for Trump supporters. And then all hell is go along with any damn thing with the leftists. It's getting out of hand.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Leo in Wicker Park.
Yeah, and Amy, have you read the bill in Texas?
Yeah, I have. Have you?
Okay, and they have increased the hours and the voting places, but except in minority, like in Harris County, they cut it in half, and they have made Sunday unavailable for people who work multiple jobs.
Is that all you have? The floor is yours, and so keep going. What else you got?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I can please.
Keep going. Well, the other question I have for you is, I think
really
people have the right not to take a vaccine, not to wear a mask. They have the right to smoke cigarettes. They have the right to drink. And I think they should do that. And, you know, therapeutics, we're not really sure about those either, because that's a government thing. And so maybe people should just go out and
it's not a government
have
thing.
Fun.
No, it's not a government thing.
Ignore all the government issues.
I don't know.
You know,
I thought you called in to talk about the Voting Rights Act, the voting rights issue.
I'm talking about all of it.
Oh.
Why not? Why
sure.
do we have to restrict the floor?
I'm not restricting the floor. I just don't know what you want me to respond to. Do you
want
to talk about the White Sox?
Respond.
Anything?
You
don't want me to respond. No,
anyhow.
Perfect. Perfect.
You know, truth,
you're a perfect liberal. Perfect leftist. I don't want you to respond. Of course. You just
want to
talk.
Truth is what you want it to be. That's how you live your life.
Right. Because
you only want to succeed and move the flag forward and get power. You don't really care about things like people and stuff like that.
No, I know. Leo, you do. You're a people person.
I don't care either, man. I don't care.
Oh, you don't care about people. I thought I'm a bad person because you just said I don't care about people, but you said you don't care about people either. What's going on?
No, I think people should do whatever they want to do.
It doesn't sound like it.
Sure. Go ahead. Knock yourself out.
Oh, you're a libertarian now. You went from a leftist to a libertarian just in this call.
Totally.
Oh, you are.
You want to put me in a box? I'm sorry. You can't do that.
Put you on a box? What does that mean? What does put you on a box?
You want to put a label on me.
No, I just...
That's how you live. You live on moving your flag forward.
I asked the question.
You know, what's your
so
that's how you
you were
live.
Just you see I'm a confused because you're on the one hand promoting government.
You're confused all the time, but truth.
Right.
You
yeah.
have your own inner truth.
Yes,
and truth sets you free because you believe only what you want.
It's a wonderful turn of a phrase. See, you were promoting government, and then you call yourself a libertarian. That's my confusion about your confusion.
Promoting government? Who's promoting government?
You were sarcastically talking about all these things that people shouldn't do.
Sarcastic?
You sarcastic? No, you're matter of fact. Is this your matter of fact tone of voice?
Sure.
Sure it is. Bye, Leo. That was fun.
You're an idiot.
Yeah. And that was President Obama saying that about you, Leo.
Oh, okay.
Gosh.
I'll walk his dogs barking.
Yeah. Leo in Wicker Park is wonderful. It's a wonderful example of the kind of productive conversations you can have on the merits with men and women of the left, isn't it? Leo listens to Kamala Harris and nods his head and says, "Thank you, Madam Vice President." And then he calls himself a libertarian. Mm-hmm. Which is, by the way, we could go down a whole rabbit hole about how close many libertarians are to being leftists because, you know, the godless kind. But I digress. That would be about 5 to 10 feet too deep for Leo to swim in if we went in that end of the pool. Don and McHenry.
Well, to spin a phrase, that's a time of my life I'm never going to get back, Dan. So
yeah, sorry.
I appreciate that. But yeah. You're a good person, Dan. That's
oh, thank you.
And you care about people.
I do.
And I care about
you just don't want to be around them.
You care.
I care about them from a distance.
I don't want to be around them.
Safe distance.
I don't want to marry any of them, obviously, but that's a whole different topic.
No. Safe distance.
First of all, I'm going to be, I'm moving to the state next week from, I think I told you guys recently, I will soon be formally Don of McHenry, and that'll be next week. I'll be going to visit the heroes in Texas, these Democrats, so looking forward to that. But I have a question, because I've not heard one statement from these people, and this may be just because I've missed it, of what specifically is Jim Crow-esque about the Texas law that has been flying all the way to D.C. and being heroes?
That would have been a great question for Kamala Harris to answer.
If someone would ever ask it. Yeah,
or Leo.
Obviously isn't going to.
Yeah, it's good.
What's their point of contention?
Thanks for the call, Don. Because
they want 24-hour voting.
And they want the Zucker boxes.
Yeah, the Zucker box. And then they want the drive-thru. Drive-thrus are made for fast food, folks.
And you heard Leo's
drive-thru voting
Sunday, you know.
Well, they are letting vote you can vote on Sundays. They just cut down the hours a little
bit. You
can,
look, we need to be able to vote in the 2022 and 2024 elections before there are even candidates who filed.
Exactly.
We need to be able to vote.
You need your ballot now.
We need to be able to vote
and
now.
You can make Xerox copies of it.
If you can find one, if you don't live out in the sticks where there are no Kinko's or Office Depot's.
Right.
But we need to get ballots now, and we need to be able to do this whenever we want to do it and drop it off wherever we want to drop it off to whatever ballot harvester we want to use in the neighborhood. We should just have voting 24/7, 365, with no requirements. And, yeah.
But the Republicans, you know, they want to avoid voter fraud.
We live in an a la carte
world. I know
world.
It's crazy, guys. But remember what President Biden said, what this is about.
The president saying new laws in more than 16 states are part of a painful pattern aimed at denying minorities and women the right to vote.
Yeah, I know. Well, you
this
heard it
painful
from...
pattern. I mean, I didn't know women were being suppressed with our vote. Did you know that, Dan? I had no idea. I want to know how, though.
Yeah.
How am I being suppressed from voting? All my sister friends, too.
Right. 21st century Jim Crow, Jim Crow assault. The Confederates didn't breach the Capitol. By the way, that's the same guy who said, about gun rights. What are you going to do? Take over the government? You can't take over the government. You need, planes and bombs to do that. So on the one hand, there was almost a coup d'etat. On the other hand, it's a joke. Mm-hmm. And by the way, with the exception of a handful, they didn't even have guns on January 6th. All of this, it's all of the same kind. It's all stitched together, this, race identitarian hustle they use. I mean, think about the kind of person you have to be, how craven and vacuous you have to be to compare Frederick Douglass or the suffragettes to a gaggle of Texas state legislators who accomplished the daunting task of flying to Washington, D.C.
with a case of Miller Lite.
And think about that same question when you hear the likes of Jim Clyburn, Joe Biden's savior, political savior at least, the House Majority Whip for Nancy Pelosi, say this about Democrats' position on voter IDs.
Let's go to Representative James Clyburn right now, the South Carolina Democrat, is also the House Majority Whip. And Congressman, always good to have you. You have been pushing for lifting the filibuster to address matters like these, like a federal election law. Does this reinforce that position?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me, Neil.
Sure.
Thank you. What I've been pushing for is to treat constitutional issues like voting the same way we treat the budget. We have allowed for a budget to be considered without any one person being able to threaten the full faith and credit of the United States of America. I think we'll do the same thing when it comes to constitutional rights. If you want to talk about a legislative issue like building a wall, how high it should be, how wide it should be, those are legislative issues that's got nothing to do with the Constitution. So, yes, I do believe that we ought, if you don't have the filibuster, limit the filibuster to legislative issues. Do not allow it to apply to constitutional issues.
So, Congressman, when you said you were absolutely open to Joe Manchin's proposed voter ID requirement, which did seem to represent a significant pivot on your part, is that your way of saying, let's get past the ID thing and on to other matters to get this law done?
You know, Neil, I don't know why people keep misrepresenting stuff. There's not a single time that I've ever voted in my entire life. And I'm going to be 81 years old next week. There's not a single time that I voted when I did not ID myself. What I spoke about was allowing an ID, a picture ID of a hunter's license to be good, but of a student activity card to be no good. That's the kind of voter ID law that I'm talking about that's unfair. I've said that all of my life. I don't know why you guys keep misrepresenting what I said. I have never said that you should not have voter ID. When I got my voter registration card, I keep it in my wallet. And when I go to vote, I present it there. every time. And I say to them, I am Jim Clyburn. This is my ID, and I want to vote. I've always had voter ID. And that's why the representative earlier told you, no Democrat has ever been against voter ID.
There it is. No Democrat has ever been against voter ID. Well, the vice president on an interview with BET on Friday said voter ID presents some real problems for rural voters because they can't photocopy their license or their ID and send it in with the ballot because they live in 18th century America.
It's been said that minorities, they can't find where the DMV is to get a driver's license, or they can't go on the internet because they don't have the internet. If they do have a computer, they don't know how it works.
Factually untrue. Mm-hmm. I mean, just as the vice president just said that on Friday.
Yeah.
Democrats, no Democrat has ever opposed voter ID. And oh, by the way, Jim Clyburn has, you know, voter ID, your driver's license is good. Your student activities card at college should be good, too. The reason it's not, Jim, or shouldn't be, it's not and shouldn't be in most places, is because sometimes kids go out of state for college. And so the student activities card doesn't establish your residency, like, for example, a government-issued ID. Is that fair? Have you considered that, Jim? Of course he's considered it. And he wants college kids to vote wherever they are, wherever they're most advantageous to whatever's going on in the state. Yeah. And so if there's something hot going on and you're an Illinois college kid in, you know, Georgia, then we want you to vote in Georgia. If you're a Georgia kid in Illinois and there's something hot going on in Illinois, then we want you to vote at U of I. I mean, it's just, this just isn't that complicated if you could strip away all of the personality politics, all of the, you know, I hate Trump, I hate Republicans, don't like minority, disenfranchising minorities, all these sort of just sweeping generalizations based on nothing. Just personality and identity politics. So I don't have to look at the underlying issue. I can just say, like Leo in Wicker Park, I don't like this guy talking on the radio, and I don't like Trump or whoever, so I don't have to address any of the merits. I can just say, you're a bad person, and I don't have to address what the actual discussion is. Tony and Steger.
Yeah, I watched an interview yesterday with one of those dumb Democrats. And he says there's 150,000 people in the state of Texas that don't have an ID. Well, if they don't have an ID, they really shouldn't need federal money for infrastructure, because they don't need roads and highways, because nobody has a license to drive anyway.
Yeah, all right. Thanks, Tony. Vince in St. Charles.
Morning, guys. My hero are the Republicans' heroes are the people who took the passengers who took down Flight 93 around 9/11 at 9/11, and the left heroes are the overpaid politicians who do nothing. That's the difference.
Thanks, Vince. And by the way, just so there's some intellectual consistency, which you will not find on leftist media outlets or in them, and you didn't find it in this one, Vox.com. See, I read the other side, too. 11 Oregon Republican lawmakers on the run from the law, having fled the state Senate in Salem on Thursday to deny a quorum for a vote on a major climate change bill. On Friday, state lawmakers announced they were shutting down the state capitol on Saturday after receiving credible threats from militia groups who support the Republicans in hiding. Of course, you know, this is white supremacy. Hateful ideology behind anything Texas Dem state legislators do, of course. But anyway, Kate Brown authorized state police to find the Republican lawmakers and bring them back. I said that was a dumb idea when Greg Abbott suggested he would do that. It's a dumb idea when Kate Brown is doing it. Is anybody else so consistent? No. Oregon Republicans fleeing to avoid voting on the climate change bill. Is that a good idea? No, it's a dumb idea. As Ducey had a good exchange with Psaki yesterday. Did Joe Biden, when he was a senator for 3.5 decades, ever flee because he knew he was going to be on the losing side of a vote? No, of course not.
Great question.
Because that's not what you do. I mean, it is absolutely a stunt. It does not drive an intelligent debate. And of course, it doesn't change the trajectory of the legislation because you're fleeing because you're in a minority position, and the majority will have its way one way or the other until and unless you can become the majority. If you think this is the way to a majority rule, I think you'd be wrong, and you'd be wrong in trying it in the first place because it's beneath the dignity of public office. At least it used to, something at least that used to be attendant to public office decency, which is not in most places these days. So Oregon Republicans are wrong. Wisconsin Democrats were wrong. Texas Democrats are wrong. Kate Brown is wrong. Governor Abbott was wrong to suggest this is a police matter. You want to, anybody on the left want to have that conversation? You want to play me, you know, whataboutism? You're not going to play with me.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now. And make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I'm a middle school teacher, and I see how critical race curriculum is creating hostility in school. This op-ed by a teacher in Providence, Rhode Island at legalinsurrection.com. I have been a public school teacher for the past 22 years, the past 7 in Providence, Rhode Island. I was awarded the English Speaking Union Shakespeare Scholarship for Excellence in Teaching Shakespeare. Teaching Shakespeare? Who does that anymore? I was designated by the Rhode Island Department of Education as a highly qualified teacher. I have tenure and experience in my certifications. I love being a teacher, and I care a great deal about my students, almost all of whom are non-white. But she does not care for the new curriculum. During the fall 2020 semester, we were given our curriculum timeline on the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. I noticed the stories and books seemed to focus almost exclusively on slavery and racism. Those were appropriate topics that we always taught, but the focus has become narrow, excluding many other aspects of history. She's talking about critical race theory curriculum, even though, as she notes, you won't see the words critical race theory in the materials, but those are the concepts that are being taught. Missing from our curriculum during the 2021 school year was the diversity, perspective, truth, and rigor that previously were taught. Previously vetted books were removed from our classroom and sent to recycling. Gone was the diverse collection of American and world literature. House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros, James Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain. Oh, James Baldwin got clipped. Wow. Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, essays by Martin Luther King, poetry by Maya Angelou, Robert Frost, Anne Frank, Knight, Elie Wiesel, The Boy in Striped Pajamas, Macbeth, Walt Whitman, The Salem Witch Trials, The Crucible.
Wait, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas got banned?
Holocaust studies, world genocide, ruled out, universal themes, universal characters, and any book or short story from the literary canon. Oh, no, the canon is out. The Western canon? It's all a product of structural racism.
Wait, what is left that you just read, you know?
You know what's left. We've been talking about it before just about anybody else was talking about it, at least in radio. What's left is Ibram Kendi, a.k.a. Henry Rogers, and Robin DiAngelo, and the Identitarians. Sometime around January of this year, hundreds of new leaflet-style booklets arrived, all poorly written, historically biased, inaccurate, and pushing a racial narrative, she writes. I noticed the book covers right away. They were odd. In some cases, the book covers browned out the faces of historical characters like Lincoln to look black or brown. None of the books were recognizable, and all of the booklets seemed to revolve around slavery or oppression. She thought it was a mistake. She thought it was a joke. No. In isolation and without historical perspective, the thematic message in every book, white Europeans were and are evil, and African Americans were and are victimized by white oppressors. Class dismissed. Then she screenshots directives from the administration. System-wide directive to separate white and non-white teachers for training on the new curriculum. It's collegial. Nah, of course, we Oak Park River Forest was at the tip of that spear with the segregation, the new segregation. You want to talk about new Jim Crow, the new segregation in schools. This is a couple years ago now. Right, first segregate the students, then segregate the teachers. Then what started happening as this new curriculum is implemented? How quickly it can happen when you're talking about, to borrow from the dearly departed Rush Limbaugh, skulls full of mush. Standing for the Pledge of Allegiance was no longer something her students did. We are not allowed to question why. The truth is, I knew why. Already, these young people were beginning to hate America. I was the only person standing and the only person that could be heard saying liberty and justice for all. Midway through the academic year, some students started calling me America because I was white. These students, whom I love, were turning against me because of my skin color. I don't blame them. I blame the racial narratives being forced upon them in school. Several of my colleagues stated I had white privilege. I was quickly made to feel as though I was becoming the enemy. You have white privilege, Bessinger. Your gestures are a rich person's gestures. Her name is Ramona Bessinger, by the way. You have white. Your gestures are a rich person's gestures. What is that? I'm holding out my hand for the Grey Poupon. What is a rich person's gesture? This is it. Intellectually rigorous. You want your kids in these schools? Are you out of your mind? The school culture for many was becoming increasingly tense. Oh, really? Gee, I wonder why. Children ask questions about the never-ending thematic focus on slavery. They asked me to tell them why I lived in a white castle. Where were my students hearing this? Gee golly, I wonder. At my school, the increasing hatred toward America seemed on the rise. I blame the books. I blame the media. The literature showing kids themes akin to America is bad, and white people are the enemy. While some teachers embrace this ideology, many secretly modify the lessons to include historically accurate supplemental materials. I have raised my concerns about the unvetted curriculum internally within the school system, also in public testimony before a Rhode Island State Senate committee. In response, I've been subjected to attempted intimidation and harassment. Of course. And so we'll see how that story ends. But culturally responsive teaching, which we have here in Illinois, same deal in Rhode Island, and critical race theory, which is everywhere. And so, you know, when Jason Riley, whose work I really like, I enjoy him, Wall Street Journal op-ed writer, writes that critical race theory is just a race hustle. It is a race hustle, but it's not just a race hustle. It's not just about Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo and their ilk getting rich. It is much worse than that, much more dangerous than that. It's what's happening in classrooms like Ramona Bessinger's classroom and school in Providence, Rhode Island. So you better gird your loins if you plan on leaving a free country for your kids. I'll just say that. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Meanwhile, how are we doing on educating kids in the big urban centers? Baltimore.
Oh, this is...
We talked about Baltimore in March. There was a local expose on Baltimore's school system, the government school system there. A school system where 80% of the kids are black and 40% of the teachers are. Well, another expose by the Fox affiliate there. 41% of all Baltimore City high school students earn below a 1.0 grade point average. In other words, nearly half of 20,000 public high school students earn less than a D average. And now what do you do? Now they're 18. Now what do you do?
Parents need school choice. Can you get rid of the union there? Because they're not really doing their job, the teachers' union. If 41% of this population is failing, and yeah, they can blame some of it on COVID because they never went back for in-person learning.
They have a 1.0 grade point average.
1.0.
You know, 40% of all Baltimore City high school students. So many of them have been in school pre-COVID. And oh, by the way, there's something more fundamental going on here. So this was the report that we brought you in March from that Fox affiliate in Baltimore. That good for them. They're staying on this topic. The story of Tiffany France and her son. Take a listen.
He's stressed, and I am too. Like, I told him I probably would start crying. Like, my son is, I don't know what to do for him.
This coming June is when Tiffany France thought her son would receive his diploma.
And I'm just trying to fight. He like, Mom, what was all this for? What did I do this for? Like, don't he get a chance? Do he get a chance?
But after 4 years of high school, this mom just learned her 17-year-old has to start over. He's been moved back to ninth grade.
Why would he do 3 more years in school? He didn't fail. The school failed him. The school failed at their job. They failed. They failed. That's the problem here. They failed. They failed. He didn't deserve that.
France's son attends Augusta Fell Savage Institute of Visual Arts in West Baltimore. His transcripts show in 4 years, he has passed just 3 classes, earning 2.5 credits, which places him in ninth grade. But France says she didn't know that until February. She has 3 children and works 3 jobs. She thought her oldest son was doing well because even though he failed most of his classes, he was being promoted. His transcripts show he failed Spanish 1 and Algebra 1, but was promoted to Spanish 2 and Algebra 2. He also failed English 2, but was passed on to English 3.
I'm just assuming that if you are passing, that you have the proper things, you know, to go to the next grade. And, you know, the bright grades, you have the right credits.
As we dig deeper into her son's records, we can see in his first 3 years at Augusta Fells, he failed 22 classes and was late or absent 272 times. But in those 3 years, only one teacher requested a parent conference, which France says never happened. No one from the school told this mother her son was failing and not going to class.
Yeah.
France's son, in his 4 years at Augusta Fells, earned a grade point average of 0.13. He only passed 3 classes. But his transcripts show his class rank is 62 out of 120.
Class rank 62 out of 120 with a 0.01 grade point average?
0.1. Yeah, 22 of 25 classes in 3 years he failed.
Teachers failed him.
Middle of the pack. 41% of high school students earn below 1.0 GPA, the story out of Baltimore yesterday. 22 of 25 classes he failed, 270-plus absences. His class rank is middle of the pack. And you tell me that 80% of the kids black, 40% of the teachers are black. The power structure, political power structure in Baltimore is black, as it is in Chicago. And I'm sorry, where does the critical race theory come in to explain this? And
now they have more money because of COVID relief funds. And are they going to see any change?
Forget the money. The money is irrelevant. You could almost $28,000 a kid in CPS. Make it $100,000. Make it $1 million. It wouldn't matter. Because it's not for the kids, it's for the adults. So tell me again about what you think the schools in the suburbs are going to turn into when all of the Western cannons are struck like they were in Providence, Rhode Island, and in comes all this identitarian political activist dreck. That's been the feature of the Chicago Teachers Union and every other big city teachers union in this country that wants to ram this down the throat of kids, not just in the cities, but now you have the same mentality that is invading the suburbs and the exurbs and rural communities. Am I starting to get your attention that K-12 education is about more than not wearing a mask?
The difference is CPS would have just given him his diploma. where Baltimore Baltimore sent him back to ninth grade. I'm saying CPS would just go, because I know some teachers that have had to do things that they did not want to do, but they were encouraged to just get the seniors out of here so we can have a higher graduation rate this year.
Well, of
course. Did you hear that?
Of course.
CPS has the highest graduation rate we've ever had. How did that happen?
Well, they were passing them on. You just
heard. Exactly, but they didn't pass
them
out the door.
Yeah, well, so one person in the system. The whole scam relies on, not one person to come forward and say no. And so somebody did in Baltimore. Congratulations. You know, the one honest member of the Politburo in Baltimore. Speaking of which, here's what they had to say in response to this story about Tiffany France's kid with a 0.1 GPA.
We received this two-page statement, which explains what should happen when a student is chronically absent or failing. The district says students received a letter about their academic status this past summer, and records can be accessed through the campus portal. When a student is absent, an automated call is placed to the number on file. The statement also said the school conducted recent home visits, and the student's parent visited the school. But France says none of that happened. What this statement does not address is why France's son was promoted despite failing classes. It doesn't discuss his class rank or the 58 other students with a GPA of 0.13 or lower.
I mean, how do you think this ends? In Baltimore, in Providence, Rhode Island, you think this ends positively? Good night. Jordan in Antioch.
Good morning. It's on both fronts, though, right? You got a crappy school district that's just pushing kids through so they can get their numbers and they can get their funding. And then the other side, you got a mom who, on the surface, seems like she's doing the best she can, but is she? I mean, I got an app on my phone. I got a website I can go to. I can, by the minute, I can check to see if my son's turning in his homework, if he's at school. Yep. I can see the notes from the teacher. It takes two, you know. I always tell my son, and I'm hard on him, but I'm doing the best I can. I'm not the best dad, and my wife's not the best mom, but we do the best we can. You can't just turn them over.
I'm telling your wife you said that.
She's probably listening. I'll hear about it later.
At least you downloaded the app. I mean, a lot of parents don't even do that to check on their kids.
No.
Go ahead. Nonstop. We are always, because I always tell him, he's not at a disadvantage. There's no... This whole white privilege thing is bull crap. It's, you just have better parents. There's no accounting for bad parenting. And she sounds like a great lady, but are you doing everything you can? Or are you just, she just said the school's failing. It's their job. Well, it is. It is. It's my job to pick up your garbage. It's your job to get it through the street and make sure it's in the can, right? It takes two people.
Yeah.
Everything takes two. You have to be invested in your kid.
No question, Jordan. Thanks for the call. And there's parental responsibility here. You're right. Tiffany Fran seems like a nice lady, and I'm with three jobs and a family. I understand. But 270 absences and those grades, I mean, yes, you can say the school's culpability is obvious. But she has responsibility for her son, too, regardless of the circumstances. And it's hard to believe it's hard to make the case she shouldn't have known what was going on to some extent. I agree. Rick in Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. Hey, you were saying about what do you do with the 40% with the 1.0 GPA?
Yeah.
Well, if I know Democrats and the left, they're going to try to get them into Harvard at the expense of some Asian kid with a 4.0. Yeah. That's their goal.
Rick, thanks. Holly in St. Louis.
Well, the conversation changed a little bit since I called in, but I was going to tell you, this has been going on a long time and in rural areas. Mm-hmm. For instance, my daughter in a high school in Normal, Illinois, 6 years ago, I was dropping her off. She was a freshman. And she said, oh, gosh, today's going to be terrible. I said, why? And she said, oh, we have to do the privilege walk. And I said, what are you mm-hmm. talking about? She said, oh, it's where we all have to line up in the back of the room. And right off the bat, the first question is, if your parents are still married, you have to take two steps forward. What? And the game progressed like that until you were the furthest forward. You had to turn around and apologize to everybody behind you for your privilege. So right off the bat, she's so angry that her parents are still married. And then to make matters worse, she still lives in the same house she was born in. So that's another step up. Her dad went to college. That's another step up. And before you know it, meritocracy is the villain, and anything your parents have worked for or done is wrong and bad, and you are responsible for, and it's on your shoulders. So as a 14-year-old, you are really regretting your lot in life, that you were raised to be better, to get better, because there's a war on meritocracy now, and the playing field has to be leveled, and they do that by shaming kids out of achievement, and that is absolutely not going to fly in Holly's household.
In Holly World.
In Holly World, yeah. And
exactly. The call went to the principal. The thing was taken off the internet, off the website of the teacher, and the reason for doing it, and that. But I'm sure now it's the rage.
Thanks, Holly.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, building on the conversation we had at the end of last hour about, in part, Baltimore City high schools, where 41% of high school students have a GPA below 1.0.
Let that sink in again.
Low D average. And how's that going to go for you, for them, and for us, when you don't educate the next generation of Americans? Boston. On Friday, federal judge William Young withdrew an earlier opinion approving new admissions plan for three elite Boston public schools. The new plan aimed to substitute grades and zip codes for a competitive enterprise, competitive entrance exam, which was designed to reduce the number of white and Asian American students. How do we know this? There were emails unearthed from members of the Boston School Committee where they explicitly say this. That's how we know it. So the judge took the extraordinary step of withdrawing an earlier opinion, the first time he had done that apparently in his 36-year judicial career, because the school system's attorneys misled him. The emails and texts have statements like this from board member Alexandra Olivia Davila, saying she's sick of Westie Whiteys. Me too. I really feel like saying that. Committee Chairman Michael Locanto mocked the Asian names of some of those who commented. All three have since resigned. Wall Street Journal opining on this. Americans are awakening to the reality that for all their talk about diversity and inclusion, today's progressives want to discriminate by race. If black and Latino children are not scoring high enough on competitive exams to get into the best public schools, the progressive answer isn't to lift the achievement or approve K-8 schools. Their answer is to suppress merit and deny seats to Asian Americans in particular. The main result is more bitterness, more resentment, more racial division, right? More unfairness. And, American people don't like things that are patently unfair. But it's systemic. And by the way, why do this way? Because just sort of, identity culture, I'm Latino, so I'm for Latinos, I'm black, I'm for blacks. I think it's a little bit deeper than that and a little bit more cynical. They are operating systems in big cities, school systems talking about, and frankly, government generally in big cities that do not deliver what they promise to deliver. And so you see this in educational outcomes, and then you see it in median household income. And so what do they need to do to paper over their failure? They need to move more people along who are the victims of their failure and their failed systems so that they are not continuing to reside in the lowest quintile of American economic life. Because those who are advancing based on merit do quite well in this country, and I'm talking about minority groups, black and brown people. So again, 2019, just a bit of a refresher here, 2019 median U.S. household income by ancestry group, the highest in the nation, Indian, Taiwanese, in order, Taiwanese, Filipino, Indonesian, Pakistani, Iranian, Lebanese, Japanese, Turkish, Chinese, Korean, Syrian, Hmong, Vietnamese, Cambodian, white. A dozen down the list. After white, Ghanaian, Bangladeshi, Guyanese, Egyptian, Palestinian, Thai, Laotian, Nigerian. But this is a country that's systemically racist against people who are not descendants of the Europeans. Really? I think that's a tough case to make out on the merits, don't you? For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by my initial candidate for president in 2016.
He's the man who got your votes.
A guy I supported. He is the former Wisconsin governor, Scott Walker, who is now the president and CEO of Young America's Foundation. Scott, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning. Good to be with you. Good
morning. The whole critical race theory, and we see this on the college campus. I mean, we see this on college campuses. This is sort of the ground zero for it. Most recently, here's an example. Student club at North Carolina demands anti-racist alerts when white supremacists come to campus. And of course, white supremacists would include the head of a pro-life group. It was because promoting life for all races is somehow white supremacist, too. I don't understand. But that's the culture in education from pre-K through college. And the results are in, and they're devastating.
Yeah, they really are. And it's something we've warned about for years on college campuses, but increasingly it's happening from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade. Maybe one of the few silver linings of the pandemic over the past year and a half has been that parents have been able to see what their kids are learning, and they're starting to speak out. Because let's be clear, critical race theory is really nothing more than state-sanctioned, government-sanctioned racism. And we got to push back against that. Martin Luther King, probably the world's most renowned civil rights activist, obviously, in his greatest speech, talked about having a dream that his children would grow up in a country where they'd be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin. And what you're talking about people are doing across the country runs absolutely counter to that.
And in the article, though, you wrote for the Washington Times in your op-ed, you mentioned that instead of teaching critical race theory, we should be teaching children's about the privilege of living in the United States.
That's exactly right. I said, we don't have white privilege. We have red, white, and blue privilege.
Yeah.
Too many people don't understand American world history or economics for that matter, because if they did, they'd understand, you know, comparing to people like those protesting as we speak in Cuba, those who were protesting over the past year in Hong Kong, other places around the world, what did they do? They raised the American flag mm-hmm. as a symbol of freedom and opportunity that's uniquely available to the masses here in America. And sadly, our schools and our colleges and universities are teaching our students the opposite. And I would add, I was listening in as you were talking, and I think there's two parts to it. One, I think you're exactly right. Too many of the government-run schools, they're covering up for the true racism, the systematic racism, which is the racism of low standards, that they're not teaching children in general, but particularly Black and Hispanic children, the fundamentals. But I also think it's part of this larger thing. It goes beyond just school, where Marxists tried to come into America decades and decades ago and failed because we're not a class-based society. I mean, in Illinois, either in the spectrum, you think of two widely known American presidents, Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama, both came, were raised out of very simple, if not poverty-stricken families, and yet became president. Shows that anyone can succeed. So the Marxists couldn't succeed based on income envy, and now have come back and tried to pit one group of Americans versus another based on race and sex and gender, and we can't let that happen.
And, you know, then they have to manufacture racism whereas it doesn't exist, which is this whole, you're familiar when Democrats flee a state, as happened to you with your budget repair bill back when you were governor. They came to Rockford, as I recall. And so the Texas Democrats doing it because they won't have 24-hour or drive-through voting in Harris County. Harris County, which saw a turnout, 65.86% turnout in November of 2020. The statewide average in Texas was 66.73. Not much different. And as Carl Rove writes, 130 Texas counties without 24-hour or drive-through voting had higher turnout than Harris. Why is that? Maybe it's just interest level. Could be that. But the whole idea that this is Jim Crow 2.0 and that the Texas Democrats who abdicated to D.C., as Kamala Harris said, are 21st century Frederick Douglasses and Susan B. Anthonys. I mean, it's really incredible, the rhetoric.
Well, it is, and I think, again, much like what they're doing with students, I think it's racist to say that because someone's color, they're not able to show a photo ID or to do it. In this case, they added it for those voting via absentee ballot, that they can't follow the same guidelines, simple common sense guidelines, that everybody else is within a given jurisdiction. Bottom line is, Wisconsin, a decade ago, not only did people flee to run away from our reforms, they went to the old Clock Tower Inn in Rockford, which is no longer. In fact, I'll be nearby there in a couple days on my way to Dixon, to the Ronald Reagan Boyhood Home, where we're having a student event there. But they fled there. We ultimately prevailed by being patient and not backing away, even when 100,000 protesters occupied our state capitol. But in this case, they need to be patient and realize, look at other states, including Wisconsin. I signed as well a decade ago photo ID requirement to vote. We use it for absentee voting. We have similar requirements in writing and a uniformity in terms of early voting across the state. And last November, despite all the claims a decade ago when these reforms passed, last November, more than 70% of the eligible voters in the state of Wisconsin turned out to vote, one of the highest in the nation and one of the highest in decades. It just shows that their rhetoric doesn't match the facts.
Well, did you threaten the Democratic legislatures back then, saying, you know, when you come back, I'm going to arrest you, similar to what Greg Abbott did in Texas?
We had called out the state patrol to go check senators' homes. They obviously then fled to Rockford. A few went to Chicago, as I understand. The state Senate majority leader and president put their stopped their paychecks from being deposited into their paycheck or into their bank account instead. Printed a check out and locked it in their desk on the floor of the state Senate.
That's a good idea. I like that. Yeah.
Saying, you want your check, come and show up for it. Unfortunately, what happens, and I'm sure is happening in Texas, is you get all these national groups, these liberal activist groups, who will just subsidize these lawmakers as long as they're willing to hold out. And I think Greg Abbott's going to do what we did, and that is you got to stay firm. You got to not back down. And I think in their case, sooner or later, there's going to be other pieces of legislation that are important, hopefully, to those lawmakers, and they're going to hear from their constituents and have to come back.
Yeah.
But if I was Abbott and his allies in the legislature, I wouldn't back down.
Yeah, and the problem is those Texas Democrat legislators are easy to subsidize. You just need to get them a case of Miller Lite, and then they seem to be fine. And by the way, when you scrambled the state police to check on legislators back in the day, I recall asking you to scramble the National Guard in Wisconsin, and since they're in Rockford, why don't you just go ahead and invade Illinois and take it over? And you chose not to do that, much to our chagrin. So sorry about that.
Well, I figured I didn't want to accidentally take a few Bears fans up with me.
You always got to go to the Packers-Bears thing.
You cheese heads, it always goes to the Bears.
Basketball. I give you, we're excited with the Bucks.
That's right.
But you've got one for the thumb, so we'll never be able to compete with Jordan and the Bulls. So you always got that.
There you go. You mentioned Cuba, and I just want to get your reaction to this. I just thought this was an incredible headline. Reuters. Cuban protests risk exacerbating COVID-19 spike.
Oh, my.
So, you know, the subtext of this is real simple, is a unwillingness to criticize communist dictatorships. And basically, the posture of Reuters and the D.C. press corps is live on your knees unless you're Black Lives Matter, which is to say, unless you're a Marxist. That's the only group that gets a pass, is Marxists out protesting in the streets last summer. But otherwise, live on your knees because COVID is the most important thing in human existence.
Well, and think about this. BLM, the organization, put out a statement basically blaming this all on the United States. Remarkable that is, and claiming, you know, that Cuba had this great history of humanitarian medical relief. Yeah, they sell off, you know, they force people into the medical profession and then sell their services to other countries while their people are suffering in Cuba. It's a great reminder to every young person in particular who doesn't know anything else about the world. Look at Cuba. The reason they're out in the streets is because, yeah, there are shortages, but that's what happens when you have communist and socialist regimes. And for all this bogusness about the embargo doesn't apply to medicine. The embargo doesn't apply to food. So that's just nonsense. The reality is, They promise power to the people. And instead, as we see in Cuba, power goes to elite, suffering goes to the masses. That's what you get under communism and socialism. And I stand with the people of Cuba and anywhere else in the world who want to stand up against communism and stand for freedom. And we should all, too.
Yeah, but why do you think President Biden is turning his back on Cubans?
Well, I think that, you know, he gave a statement the other day and all but ignored, well, literally not all, but literally ignored the communist and the socialist regime. Warnock, I think, Senator Warnock, Raphael Warnock, was one of the most outrageous. He talked about standing with the people of Cuba against years of oppression. And I'm thinking, this is the guy who was a youth minister at the church in New York City that Fidel Castro spoke at. Who do you think was the guy who did this? It was Castro and the masses, and they've continued that. So there's, Joe Biden is afraid to stand up against his base. His base is radical. If it's not anti-American, they're not for it. And that's a big problem long term, because it used to be Democrats and Republicans could have policy debates. But I genuinely think even folks who disagree with me politically still loved America. Increasingly, that's in question, and that's troubling long term. It's why I'm doing the work I'm doing at Young America's Foundation, YAF.org, if people are interested. Send your kids, your grandkids, be involved, because we've got to fight back. Reagan warned about this. Freedom is only one generation away from extinction. We don't get it in our bloodstream. We got to stand up and fight for it and defend it and then pass it on to the next generation to do exactly the same thing.
He is former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. He's now the president of Young America's Foundation, YAF.org. If your kid's in college, just start a YAF chapter on their campus, or certainly access YAF for conservative speakers. I did 25 years ago when I was an undergrad at Northwestern. It's a great organization to help bring conservative perspectives to campus. Scott Walker, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Have a great one.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to AM 560, The Answer, online at 560theanswer.com, on the AM 560 mobile app, on your Alexa-powered smart speaker, and on TuneIn, iHeart, and on Odyssey.
Let not your heart be troubled. Listen to me, Sean Hannity. I'll have the latest news and what it all means for you. It's coming up at 2 right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. And I played golf with our next guest at Barrington Hills the other week.
When Biden came to visit, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And your game was interrupted by the chopper.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A message to the larger community. You know, you want to be on the show? Well,
take Dan to a fancy golf club. You can get on the show.
No, not at all.
Oh, no, really?
No, there's no corporate payola here. Let's be ethical. I mean, stop with your rent-seeking behavior, this cut me in or cut it out Chicago mentality that you have.
You brought it up.
No, I was kidding. The point was, got to have a conversation with him after the round in particular, and really sharp guy, and we're always looking for experts in areas, experts in all the areas that we cover, including in finance and markets. And he is one. He is James Perry. He's a senior vice president and partner at Arbor Research. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Jim, wait, real quick. No. Who's the better golfer, Dan or Jim? Yeah. And I want answers now and maybe a scorecard.
I was doing okay until the helicopters came over.
That's very, very disconcerting. Yeah, exactly.
Then I got a little nervous.
Yeah, exactly. They see a few conservatives out on a golf course. They could have had us arrested just in principle.
They were flying low.
That's right. One of the conversations we had, it was just sort of about where the market is right now. And, a lot of people surprised by its buoyancy. I mean, yes, the funny money, the quantitative easing we've been doing for a decade. But still, with the inflationary pressure, with Jay Powell saying that interest rates may have to be raised sooner than I thought, even though he's cagey about that. You continue to see mainly the tech stocks driving market returns and what the medium term perspective is, that when you've got predictions from houses like J.P. Morgan that we could see a 20-30% correction next year.
Well, I do hear those things. And I think that, that's part of the narrative in the market. I think that sometimes that narrative is slightly skewed. I always say that, you know, inflationary interest rate rises benefit those who have the most debt. And that, of course, is the government. And the secondary beneficiary is those that underwrite that debt. So the narrative on Wall Street from the big banks is that we need to have higher interest rates. And frankly, they've been calling for higher interest rates for 30 years and have been wrong. And I think the reason for it is that inflation definitely helps those that are indebted the most. And I think that this pandemic has seen a remarkable recovery. And it's been, thank goodness, something that's gotten the country and the world back on track. But I think that people have to realize that the recovery is a strong one, but so is the shutdown. And the government response to that shutdown has been extraordinary. But that influx of stimulus, both monetary and fiscal, is artificial. It's not organic growth. It's not about rising wages and rising disposable incomes and rising household incomes. It's about replacing lost wages. And I think when the narrative from the J.P. Morgans of the world, not to single them out at all, that they're doing their job, but the fact is that, you know, you cannot see an inflationary growth impulse. You cannot get a permanent structural inflationary structure from an artificial stimulus, which is going to end. And that's probably the thing, Dan, that we talked about, you know, that struck a chord with you the other day, in the sense that, you know, you just can't expect household income and disposable income and consumption to continue to rise when the incomes that are going to those households is coming from the government and is going to end.
So how will we know when sort of the end is near? I mean, in other words, the correction is upon us. Will it just be the bottom dropping out and you see the thing run down, you know, the Dow run down 20 or 30% in a very short burst? Or will there be some, you know, leading indicators that we're coming off of our sugar high?
Right. Well, I don't think so. I think this is going to be a much more, if you think from the sort of the prism of Chairman Powell, I think that if he is talking to the Senate House Committee yesterday and Senate today, his message is very simple, and that is that, you know, we have had a strong recovery, but it's got its limits. And I think what you'll see is that he's very happy with the stock market at about these levels. He's very happy with interest rates at these levels. And I think, critically, he's very happy with the dollar at these levels. If he can just keep things stabilized here, you're going to continue to see more monetary stimulus from the Fed. They're buying $120 billion worth of securities a month. He has said over and over that is not going to end. And as far as interest rates are concerned, they're going to stay at zero. So if stock investors, equity investors realize that the Fed's got their back, it's highly unlikely, unless you see some sort of a black swan event that nobody sees coming, that the stock market's going to correct by something like 15% or 25% or something like that.
Well, what about
every time the market?
No.
Go ahead.
Oh,
sorry.
No, no. Well, you can finish what you were going to say. Every time the market, what?
Well, every time the market comes down 5% or so, or 6%, you see all of these institutions out there that have free money right now. This is free credit, right? They have the ability, regardless of what the economy is doing, to put into place carry trades, which allow them to outperform the market through derivative trades. This is the high frequency algorithmic trading community is probably responsible for something like 75% of the total volumes in the markets these days. So the institutional investor that we know of, that we've seen throughout our careers, insurance companies and pensions and the like, these guys are long and they're staying long because they can't afford to be short. But they have no incentive really to liquidate their holdings because there's really not anything else that you can buy. Interest rates globally are so low, and risks in the other portions of the globe, out in Asia, Japan, and Europe particularly, the G3, you know, these countries and these regions have the same debt
and low growth conundrums that are facing America. This is not a country that is in isolation. And I think a lot of times when you see or hear the narrative from people who are really bearish on interest rates and really bearish on inflation, they don't look at the markets within the context of where investors put their money, where it's going to be safest, where they feel like they have a reasonable risk reward to that money.
Yeah, this is such an interesting point because it runs counter to the narrative as you're describing it. It's a suggestion that, where the institutional inertia is where the small investor should be and should not be looking for the first bad day in the market to pull out, should be playing a long-term game, even with some of these, wacky modern monetary theorists running around.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that to your point, Dan, the broader picture, the real big story is that, we've got a lot of debt. There's no question about it. It's phenomenal. The numbers, everybody knows them. They're big. National debt to GDP is something like $28 trillion to a GDP number, which is 22. That's over 100%. And total debt in this country is probably four times GDP. So we know all that. But the point is that what we've gotten here since the pandemic, and really since 08 particularly, is this kind of concept that debt is really, it's only debt if payment is required.
Yeah, right.
Otherwise it's credit, right? So we're this sort of era of central bank activism has changed what mathematics and economics really are. And the new administration is saying, well, debt doesn't matter. Modern monetary theory doesn't matter because we can write off the debt. So what you're getting is a credit impulse to the economy and to the markets that has never happened before. I mean, we've all heard the pandemic is unprecedented, but the response to the pandemic is extraordinary. 2 years ago, if we would have thought modern monetary theory would come to, our profit and loss statements on our brokerage accounts, everybody would laugh at you. But here we are, right? We have something like, an $8 trillion Fed balance sheet, and a fiscal stimulus is probably going to, in the next 12 months, be running at something on the order of $4 trillion. These numbers are extraordinary.
And to your point about Jay Powell not being inclined to do anything different than he's doing, I mean, the statement he made yesterday, the way he made it, it's like parsing the words of a diplomat. But he was basically like Frank Drebin in front of the exploding fireworks factory. He's talking about inflation, the highest in 13 years, fastest monthly rise in consumer prices in 13 years. He was saying it's been higher than we expected and a little bit more persistent, but there's nothing to see here.
Well, that's exactly right. And, I've not been a big fan of the Fed for a long time. And I was really hoping that for the first time since Volcker, we have a Fed chairman who was not an academic economist. Right. He was he's a businessman, and his rhetoric prior to becoming the Fed was something on the order of, it's not my responsibility to make sure that the hedge funds of New York make money, right? So I was like, oh, great, finally, he's going to unwind some of this debt. But once he gets in there, he realizes that, if he takes liquidity away from the financial system, the stock market will fall. And if the stock market falls, the economy will fall, and it'll be a much bigger recession and depression than can be imagined.
Yeah, but what about the inflation? I mean, a lot of Americans are on tight budgets and fixed incomes, and you go to the store, grocery store, or go to get gas, and products they're up 20, 30, even 40% than they were.
So, oh, yeah, it's real. It's real.
I mean, gas went from 318 to 345 yesterday, just like that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, inflation is very real. Price increases are here, and it's really hurting those that need it most. I mean, anybody that drives anything, whether it's a commute or dropping kids off or running around doing the jobs that they do, whether they're in construction or plumbing or anything, delivery, inflation really, really, really hurts. So what happens in that environment is that government realizes that, capitalism is bad and that there's a bifurcation in society and we have to send more money to the people who need it most. And I think that
Powell recognizes that, but he also recognizes that if he does not have a viable financial system, the stock market will fall. And if the stock market falls, all the paper wealth that's in the economy will disappear. And it really boils down to consumer spending. So if the top 25% of consumers quit spending, you know, it's 50% of GDP. And the other thing is that, you know, if you look at GDP, which is the output of the country at 22-odd trillion, 66% of that number is consumer spending.
Mm-hmm.
So if consumer spending drops by 50%, GDP will be negative. And if liquidity comes out of the system, the stock market will go down first, and that spending will go down. So they know that there's a bifurcation of wealth, and they recognize that at the federal level. And instead of having the response be something that makes economic sense, it right. really becomes how much more money can we give people who are not working?
Well, it becomes a death spiral in no uncertain terms. Because, I mean, so Mark Perry over at University of Michigan has Carpe Diem blog, which I frequently reference, one of the great charts of all time. He looks at the selected U.S. consumer goods and services and what they've increased in price over the last 20 years. So overall inflation,
that's a great chart, by the way.
Yeah, you know, I knew you knew it. Overall inflation last 20 years, 60%. The goods or services that have increased at more than the rate of inflation: child care, medical care, college textbooks, college tuition, hospital services, where the government right. has most thrust itself. The goods that Absolutely. Are below the inflation rate: new cars, household furnishings, clothing, cell phones, computer software, toys, TVs, where it's more of a free marketplace. And so they weaken the dollar to weaken consumer purchasing power. And then they can't afford important things like child care, medical care, hospital services. So then they increase the subsidies on those things and prop up the stock market to make the middle, the small investor feel like, well, at least my 401k is doing okay. Meanwhile, everything I have to pay is taking more of my household income, and then I'm becoming more dependent on the government. And if the market ever crashes, then I've got nothing.
Well, that's exactly right. I think if you listen to Powell, he will tell you, and a lot of smart guys will tell you this, that, you know, I have a hard time really. I think Powell's actually correct, believe it or not, in many things. He's much more worried about employment than he is about prices. And the reason for that is that the U.S. economy is unlikely to experience an inflation regime shift. And by that, I mean wages are going up faster than prices. That's mm-hmm. not going to happen. That's what happened in the 70s. And the reason that we think that's true is that as prices have come up here in the last 6 months and 3 months, hurting those who can't afford it the most, is that you're seeing a negative demand response. So all of a sudden, the sentiment toward more purchases of durable goods and houses and cars, these numbers are plummeting right now. And that's not what happened, you know, in the 20s and in the 50s and in the 70s. All of a sudden, you're getting a demand response that says, geez, my household income is going down. I don't have any disposable income. I have to cut somewhere. And what's happening now, and I think this is really extraordinary, the pandemic has accelerated trends that have been in place for decades. And that being, inflation is structural at the level of the CPI. But if you look at that chart, for example, that Mr. Perry put together, hospital services and college tuition fees and college textbooks and medical care services, these are the sectors of CPI that have been rising the most over the last 30 years. Medical care delivery in this country is over 20% of GDP, up from 10 years ago. This is all the fact that the government has taken it over. Now, with technology, for the first time in 30 years, hospital services, the delivery of medical care, college tuitions are falling. So in 2021, for the first time in 30 years, those inputs that have increased CPI the most are falling the most. So this is what Powell is talking about when he speaks of structural inflation. He's not as worried about the fact that there's container ships stuck in ports and gasoline's up and eggs are up and milk are up and copper's up and iron ore's up. All of this stuff is higher. most of that is a supply disruption. There's plenty of eggs around. There's plenty of milk around. There's plenty of oil around. You just can't get it to places.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a supply disruption, which is caused by the ability to ship goods around the country and the world. This whole globalization move that we've had in the last, 30 years, I think something like global trade is again, two-thirds of global GDP. And it's a just-in-time mechanism. And once that gets disrupted, it's very, very difficult to get it back on track. All these ships are, outside of all these ports, especially in oil and food. And I think that it's probably going to take a little bit longer than Mr. Powell thinks or the market perceives. But I really believe that there will be no taper anytime soon. There will be no rises in interest rates, and there will be no reduction of the growth in the Fed's balance sheet because they can't afford it. That is that the pandemic probably costs the U.S. economy something like 20 million jobs.
James, I'll
pick them back.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
We've gotten 10 of them back.
Halfway back. Yeah,
not coming back. And this is the problem. So that means that disposable incomes and household incomes are going to be far lower than most people think. And I saw a thing from the New York Times on Monday, and this is just a survey, but it said, and this is the New York Times, right? It said that of the households that they surveyed in a New York metropolitan region last week, one quarter of households said that they were not going to send their kids back to school and that those kids will be homeschooled. Now, imagine the hit to all the things that we used to spend on. Imagine the hit to the commuting into Chicago. Chicago's got something like 3 million people. You guys know that better than I do. But, something like 1 million people a day used to go into Chicago for work or lunch or sports or art or theater. And that number's down by 90%. And they're not taking the Metro Rail system. Everybody talks about these the prices of used cars, they're up, 50% or something. Well, that's true. There's a shortage of them because people aren't taking trains and they don't want to go into cities. But the offset to that is that, the loop and the Metro Rail system is running at unbelievable deficits. And the cost to the New York City subway system and the Metro Rail systems all around the country to these municipalities far outweighs the prices of the increases that you see in cars and used cars. So I like the J.P. Morgan story. I think there's a lot of really, really smart people there, and I think they're correct in looking at these prices that are, quite frankly, pretty macro in the grand story. And I think that Powell is correct looking at things, saying, in aggregate, transportation costs in this country are down probably by something like 30% still. Global air traffic is still down 75%. That doesn't mean there's more of a global demand for jet fuel. It means that people aren't moving. I don't know if you've seen pictures of Heathrow Airport. I was in London for a long time, and Heathrow Airport's running at 10%.
It's remarkable.
So is every airline and airport in China, in India, in Russia, in South America. You cannot fly to South America.
James, we're going to have to leave it there. James L. Perry, Senior Vice President and Partner at Arbor Research. Jim, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for your time. Good luck with everything.
Thanks.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and it looks like we have a plot twist in that story about all those hero lockdowner politicians and media types and TV doctors. Report out yesterday that U.S. overdose deaths hit a record 93,000 in 2020, a 29% increase year over year.
And if you think about it, it is the biggest increase in overdose deaths in the history of our country. And you know that most of them were caused because of the lockdowns and the isolations people felt.
21,000 more drug overdose deaths than in 2019 and 2020. And so, again, the conversation we had here from the outset was it's always going to be a question of trade-offs, lives versus lives, mm-hmm. not lives versus money, as the lockdowners wanted to make it. Lives versus lives. And the damage continues to roll in. So after the fact, after all the fun and games and the hysteria and the virtue signaling, come the real-world consequences. For more on all things COVID-related from a medical perspective, pleased to be joined again by Dr. Alan Moy, who's the Vice President of the John Paul II Medical Research Institute. Dr. Moy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're at the intersection of faith and science, and a recent piece that you wrote, and this is salient, we just talked to perhaps the most outspoken man of the cloth in the Western world, the Lutheran pastor from Calgary, Arthur Pawlowski. I mean, he's doing a tour of America to try to get American clergy to stand up and protect their houses of worship and serve the faithful. And we're having a hard time, at least we are in Chicago, with the archdiocese here, getting them to do the same. You wrote that it's time to end COVID segregation at Mass. From the intersection of faith and science, please offer your view on this.
So it's very disappointing that the Catholic Church has imposed these lockdowns and restrictions to the faith, reducing access to the sacraments, in contrast to some of these Protestant ministers who have gone so far as go to jail for what they're doing. And it's these lockdowns just don't make medical sense in terms of what they are trying to achieve. And as I stated in the article, whether you're sort of a segregating parishioners based on whether they're vaccinated or not vaccinated and wearing masks or not wearing masks is not going to achieve the mitigation in the containing this infection. It's more fear and a lack of scientific guidance that's driving this phenomena.
Well, does every church have different policies? I mean, because, you know, you could have a masked section, an unmasked section, a vaccinated section, an unvaccinated section.
So what's going on in this country is that it's dependent upon the different dioceses. So I'm sure probably in Chicago, you're probably seeing one extreme. And in Iowa, for example, different dioceses are imposing different guidelines, restrictions based on what the bishop is saying. So it really varies between diocese and diocese. And so there's dioceses around the country who have no restrictions, but they're really asking them to have a sort of a taking masks and vaccines based on being honest with what people are doing. So if you're being vaccinated, they'll say you don't have to wear a mask, and if you're unvaccinated, you should wear a mask. Well, that just seems absurd.
Yeah, it doesn't do much for fellowship in the faith community. No. And look, it seems to me that, give your perspective on this, Dr. Moy, the Catholic Church, but also other denominations, it seems to me that this is a bit of a reflection of the schisms within these faith communities more generally between those who have decided to genuflect at the altar of leftism, to use a term, as opposed to those who are interested in, well, in the Catholic faith, the catechism and Jesus Christ. It just seems that the social justice warriors and the rest of the parishioners in the Catholic setting. There's a schism there, and this is just another manifestation of that schism.
Yes, I mean, as you probably are aware, is that the Catholic Church, Catholics are very heterogeneous. There are people who are very conservative. There are very, very others that are very liberal. There are others that are support abortion and others that don't. There you do have this this heterogeneity of different political and social backgrounds who are trying to influence policies in different dioceses.
I want to get to your reaction to the science of this, because it sort of speaks to some of the silliness that you're hearing from men of the cloth, as well as public, as I said, public health TV doctors and certainly politicians, as well as, you know, functionaries like the former Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, on the vaccinations.
We are in a situation where we have a wildly effective vaccine. Multiple choices, lots available, free of charge, and we have folks who are just saying, I won't do it. I think that it's time to say to those folks, it's fine if you don't choose to get vaccinated. You may not come to work. You may not have access to a situation where you're going to put my grandchildren in jeopardy, where you might kill them, where you might put them in a situation where they're going to carry the virus to someone in a high-risk position. That's, I think, the point where we are, is freedom is one thing, but freedom when you harm others, like secondhand smoke and issues that we've dealt with very clearly in the past. You can't drive drunk. You can drink, but you can't drive drunk because you can injure other people.
Dr. Moy, what do you think? Vaccines, not getting vaccinated, the equivalent of a cancer patient refusing treatment, the equivalent of a secondhand smoke, the equivalent of driving drunk.
Well, I have to listen to her. I would say the only thing I agree with her is that the vaccines are free.
You agree, agree that they're free, yes.
Right. So it's the same talking points you hear everywhere, among even among the Catholic Church hierarchy and mainstream media and politicians. Here's the problem with that analysis. Number one, the vaccines aren't necessarily, we call them, effective. They have some books of effectiveness. The problem with the, and the second is that they don't, they make it sound like the vaccine is superior to natural immunity. That is completely false. As we have said before, natural immunity provides redundant immunity. It provides a respiratory mucosal immunity, as well as T cell and humoral immunity. Whereas this vaccine does not. It is a weak vaccine that requires a booster. Is dependent upon a single viral antigen, the spike protein, to provide all the immune protection, which it lacks respiratory mucosal immunity. And the virus is a highly genetically unstable virus that if you, and this is not anything that lay people can do, but we have looked at the genetic code of all these variants, and the what's changed among these variants is the genetic stability of the spike protein. Now, there, all the other viral antigens have some have a lot more conservation, and so the people who are in recovered from the COVID have natural immunity. They have redundant immunity to all these viral antigens. And those people who have the most resistance to the variants. And so what you're seeing is that when people have recovered, there are very few cases, rare if any, who have recovered from COVID, have been reinfected by the Delta variant. Whereas if you look at countries like Israel that have the highest vaccination rates, the most common breakthrough is due to the Delta variant. So the problem is that these variants that are emerging are due to the inability of this vaccine to really contain this to a great degree. So the effectiveness over time is decreasing.
Well, so then you mentioned you mentioned the booster then. So then is getting a booster going to be an annual event then?
Like a flu shot?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of political and pharmaceutical pressure to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we as we mentioned in the last interview, if it's just going to be trying to identify another spike protein mRNA, well, I mean, that's just going to be a very ineffective strategy. And so you have to, if you really want to, and we've had a problem for 50 years coming up with an effective flu vaccine, because this influenza is an RNA virus that is constantly changing every year. And it's in the next year flu vaccine varies in terms of its efficacy, anywhere between 5 to 10% to as high as 50%. So it's just very, very difficult to contain RNA viruses that are highly unstable. And one can make the argument that these vaccines actually may promote, accelerate variants, because the virus is trying to adapt to the pressure it's being imposed to them at the spike protein level.
He is Dr. Alan Moy. He's a pulmonologist. He's also the vice president of the John Paul II Medical Research Institute in Iowa. Dr. Moy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to AM 560, The Answer, online at 560theanswer.com, on the AM 560 mobile app, on your Alexa-powered smart speaker, and on TuneIn, iHeart, and on Odyssey.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now, and make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, good morning, and this bears repetition. Kamala Harris yesterday at one of these sort of Soviet confabs before the cameras with, I don't know, seat fillers where she bloviates on about, in this case, voting rights.
Oh, yeah, Governor Pritzker was there. He was one of three governors and five mayors were invited, and that's when she made this comment.
Like I said, seat fillers. Yeah. There's a guy who takes up the entire side of the table in terms of seat fillers.
If you saw the video, efficient. He was at the end, you know, he's at the end of the table, and he's just like, this is that exciting. Mm-hmm. I showed you the video. It's pretty.
Yeah. And then he said to Kamala Harris, hey, tell Biden he's sitting in my chair, but also I'm going to need a bigger chair. Kamala Harris saying this about those Texas Democrat socialist state legislators in exile.
We had an extensive meeting. I had an extensive meeting yesterday with, I think, some of the most courageous elected leaders that we could know at this moment. I said it yesterday, and I'll say it again. They took bold, courageous action in line with the legacy of everyone from Frederick Douglass, who's over my right shoulder, when he fought for the right of black men to vote in America, to the legacy that includes all those women who marched down Pennsylvania Avenue for women's right to vote, to all of those folks who shed their blood on the Edmund Pettus Bridge to make sure that we would, in 1965, pass the Voting Rights Act. And now we have, in 2021, the Texas legislature, many of them, traveling to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and the follow-up question should have been, has anybody contacted Jasper Johns to do a representation so they could be that could be hung on the wall in their tribute next to Frederick Douglass? Has President Biden decided whether or not he's going to give the Presidential Medal of Freedom to the members of the Texas State House Democrat delegation. Yeah,
they're heroic refugees of the left.
Does Kamala Harris say such asinine things because she is, you know, has the depth of a cookie tray? Or is there purpose to it? I think there's purpose to it, which brings to mind this most recent piece from John Gabriel over at azcentral.com. John Gabriel, who's also the editor-in-chief at ricochet.com, joins us. John, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
So what's the purpose, do you think, or is there one, behind Kamala Harris, you know, comparing Texas state legislators to Frederick Douglass and the suffragettes, or Joe Biden saying this is what's going on in Texas is Jim Crow 2.0, just like what's going on in Georgia with Jim Crow 2.0? What's the purpose behind it?
It's just this constant stoking of hysteria. Nothing can be as simple as, you know what, we disagree with this voting rules in Texas. We should change it. We should compromise, whatever, because it's such a minor deal. And all this, this is Jim Crow. No, this is Jim Crow on steroids. No, this is the worst thing since the Civil War. It's just kind of constantly stoking this panic that Washington is really good at, and the Democrats are just swinging for the fences on this stuff. It's really nuts because when we do have something serious that hits us, like, I don't know, say a $28 trillion debt, that isn't mentioned. That's not a problem. Instead, it's these very small battles in one state out of 50. That's going to be the end of democracy as we know it. And we hear the end of democracy about 50 times a day out of Washington. And when they are there to represent us, you know, we sent them there to proceed upon democracy and solve a problem or two. Instead, they're just screaming and yelling on social media.
The Chiron on CNN on the sevens is democracy in danger. You know, the recurring segment they have. I mean, you know, I read your piece, and so it got me sort of thinking too. But there's got to be a purpose behind it, right? And it seems to me, and this goes with what you mentioned as well. This turns people off. This, like, everything we disagree about is the end of democracy. It turns commonsensical people off, and I think that's part of the purpose. I think the hyperbole is intended to fuel the indoctrinated activist set and to turn off common sense people from politics so the activist set can have their way. I mean, if you're right, and my instinct is right, that this turns people off, well, then they don't pay attention when your schools get taken over with critical race theory curriculum, for example.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point, and we've been seeing that repeatedly, just more and more in politics. It's all about emotion, and that's, you know, last summer's of quote-unquote mostly peaceful protest. It's just the triumph of emotion over any kind of reason. It's fine to have emotion and be passionate about these issues you care about. I'm like that with school choice, but there has to be reason, has to be placed in gear. Or otherwise, it's just like racing from one hysteria to the next. And that's how the Democrats want to govern, because that's what the progressive activists want to see from them. It's just this constant rage, this constant panic. And, you know, we saw it all last year with coronavirus. Now we have hard data showing that drug overdoses shot through the roof. You have teen suicides way up, all these horrible things. But when you pointed that, you know, this might happen if you shut down the world for a year, you were called a grandma killer. You know, they didn't, right. You know, logic was not going to penetrate their emotion.
Or if you don't take the vaccine, you're going to kill Kathleen Sebeys' grandchildren. That's for sure.
Or she's going to kill she's going to kill your grandparents.
It's such
or something.
Hyperbole. But right. Where's the exit ramp to this craziness? How do you think this is going to end? If it ever ends.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just going to be people burning out on it. And I think you're already seeing this, you know, all last year, you know, average parents of every race and creed were called racists for, you know, opposing this critical race theory, the 1619 Project Madness. But when parents are confronted, you know, overlooking a Zoom lesson that their kids are sitting through and hearing their kids being told that white people are racist from, you know, due to genetic reasons, basically, and they're bad people and they need to repent and reform to adjust to the new progressive order, parents are saying enough. And once again, there's parents of all colors saying, you people are crazy and you need to stop teaching this. And thankfully, state legislatures around the country are starting to take action on it, at least. But the parents are just realizing, hey, this is nuts. We have to stop. We have to get off this crazy carousel that the politicians are putting us on, and just stand up for our kids. And this needs to expand to just stand up for our communities. You know, in Illinois, there's some terrible decisions being made, and it just takes the people to turn that emotion instead of just screaming on social media to give a call to their state rep and say, hey, we can't proceed in this direction. Please vote this other way. I'll remember you at election time.
Well, with the curriculum so focused on who's oppressed in this country, then we have real-world oppression that comes to the attention of those who hadn't been paying attention for, say, the last 60 years, for example, in Cuba. And it's been fascinating to witness the contortions from the left to avoid acknowledging that Cuba is a communist dictatorship, the same way they did contorted themselves to avoid having to account for their rallying for Hugo Chavez in his early days in Venezuela, as before the catastrophe inevitably unfolded. And so we have a catastrophe here, and it's all about, you know, being opposed to oppression. But this isn't about partisan fights in this country, John. We can't forget the partisan fights here. We're just standing for people's freedom and dignity. But, of course, there's no acknowledgement as to why the Cuban people don't have freedom and dignity.
Right. And you have the Biden White House, who have been welcoming people to just stream across the southern border. I live in Arizona. And we face this every day with crime coming up, with drugs coming up, and then just the people who are trying to escape a bad situation in Central America being left by coyotes out in the middle of the desert to die. They've been encouraging that nonstop. And now that we're dealing with a possible influx from Cuba, Biden's saying, hey, you know, basically build a wall. I don't know if they plan on a seawall or what, but they're like, you are not going to be allowed in this country. You stay in your own countries. Don't come here. Apply for asylum while you stay there. It's just the hypocrisy is absolutely amazing. They class Cuba as a completely different category as people who don't deserve human rights, as you say.
Well, you know, it's not only Cuba, too, but Haiti, too. They said, don't even bother coming here.
Right.
Well, they throw Haiti in because they need a cover for Cuba because, DeSantis is up for re-election next year. The last thing we need is more Cubans in Miami.
Yeah. I actually just saw him speak last night. I'm visiting Florida right now. And yeah, he brought that up and just like, hey, we're talking about human flourishing. We're talking about human freedom, and we want freedom for all people. And I don't think the press is going to sideline him on that because he's coming loaded for bear.
The only way that the Biden administration would support it is if it was like Mariel Boatlift Part 2, where you just allowed the dictators in Cuba to throw all their prisoners on a boat and send them to South Florida like they did under Carter.
Right. And I think part of it, too, is Biden being, you know, 312 years old. He remembers those old lessons. They're like, wow, that really hurt Carter. We don't want that to happen again. But boy, you just get out there giving moral support, you know, send your administration talking heads to give moral support to the Cuban people. And we could be done with a nuisance that has vexed America for 60 years. And more importantly, the freedom of the Cuban people could finally be realized.
Well, and again, it's the hypocrisy is for obvious ends, but they need to be stated explicitly, which is people that are being oppressed by their government are only interesting to these Democrat politicians to the extent that their political persuasion is known. How are they going to vote if we en masse allow them to come to this country or en masse allow them to apply for asylum? We're happy to have people in here that will be state dependents and loyal constituents. But if it's a dicey proposition, then we don't want any part of it.
Absolutely. It's just raw political power that they're trying to attain. And that's why Biden's, you know, doing things like bringing refugees, as he calls them, across the southern border and just trying to export them to other states throughout the interior. They want a dependent voting bloc, and that's all they care about. They don't care about rescuing people from a tough situation in, say, Honduras, Instead, what they want is more power. That's all they seem to care about. It's really, you know, frankly, comparing it to Cuba, it's just unpatriotic.
He is John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com, contributor to azcentral.com as well. John, thanks for joining us. As always, appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan and Amy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.